Hello and welcome to the Declined Estate Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Declined Estate is proud to bring you one of the surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. If at any point you would like to call in and weigh in on the conversation, please contact Skype user Declined Estate with a text message and we'll do our best to get you on the air. If you are interested, we may keep you on. That's Declined Estate, spelled out one word, no punctuation. You can find us on the web at our official website, declinefm.com, where you'll find a link to the live chat. And I'm proud to announce a new official iTunes podcast named, you guessed it, Declined Estate. If there's a topic you want to hear discussed on a later show, please submit to r/declinedestate@reddit.com. And links to both our live stream and archive episodes can be found at both DeclineFM and r/declinedestate@reddit.com. As always, I'm Ronald McPaul, your beacon of freedom in the heart of the Silicon Valley, announcing that the price of Bitcoins is now over $9 US. I'm joined by my handsome co-casters, and I'll let them go around and introduce themselves now. I think we got four of us on today. Go ahead, guys.
Hey guys, it's Eternal.
This is Kwashi Orkor.
Greetings, fellow travelers. This is Ninkendo.
All right, guys. I think we've kind of. I wanted to mention the Bitcoin price. And I don't know if there's any other topical noise or topical news that jumps out at you today. But if you want, I can get us into our first topic.
There's one thing I actually, now that you mentioned Bitcoin prices, if you don't mind me segueing a little bit here.
No, please.
I'm talking about the gold prices, because this is something I've had in my mind, and I haven't had a chance to talk about it yet. As people know, precious metals have been doing badly for the last several months.
Like, as an owner of some, I have noticed.
Yeah, I've been thinking about buying them, and I've been looking at it and like, oh, why is this? What's going on? And of course, you know, I've noticed a couple patterns have emerged. You know, I was, you know, doing more research and I've noticed.
Sounds like a little technical analysis.
Yeah, a little technical. More like eyeballing it. But
yeah, there you go.
The eyeballing it gave me some interesting ideas. It looks like if you go right now, check the spot price, it's about $1,575. It's pretty low.
And this is for the, I guess, the gold stock, the one that most people reference, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just at goldprice.org. That's what I use because I figure that's a good representative. Yeah, the ETFs. Right now, you know, it's about 1575. It's been hovering around between 1500 and 1700 back and forth for a while. If you go back and look over the course of really the last like 20 years or so, but not really that far, maybe like into the late 90s when you start seeing the upward trend again. You notice that at 2000, 2004, and 2008, gold did badly. And 2008, it did really badly because we had the general collapse and a lot of money was just disappearing, credit lines being cut. But the 2000 and 2004 years were not great for precious metals either. Why is this? They're election years. So I was thinking, you know, correlation, not causation, but, you know, something. And I'm thinking, well, you know, what makes sense? What would Occam's razor say about this?
So you're saying that prices have gone down or up in election years?
Down.
Okay. I mean, if you're going to ask me to apply Occam's razor here, I'd say that usually what a new president being elected to the market does is it creates uncertainty, and markets do not like uncertainty. So usually dips and things are kind of to be expected.
Yeah, I'd have to look at... Well, the thing is, like, the president doesn't take office until after. The president takes office in 2013, 2009, 2005, etc. And he's inaugurated in January. This... Definitely, it seems like what's going on is leading up to the elections, we're seeing a huge drop in price. Why would this be? My thinking is that, well, the incumbent probably tells the Fed Reserve chair, make the economy look better than it's supposed to look. Because it'll help my election chances. And that means manipulating the precious metals market.
I've heard that conjecture before, and I think there's some evidence that actually, you know, shows a concurrence between, you know, the well-being of the economy in connection with Fed actions, you know, as it correlates with the re-election cycle.
Yeah. And so, you know, what I'm thinking is, look where, you know, the line is, that the projection of gold prices over the last, I don't know, about 4 or 5 years. Really about 10 years, but if you go to like 5 years, you can see, generally speaking, it looked pretty linear up until about a year ago, up until really the election cycle started, and you had the primaries and such. Then it just went wacky. And, you know, what's really going on, I think, is that the price is being suppressed, and once the elections are over, it's going to go back up big time, because I think it's just way lower than it should be. And after the elections are over, it's going to be 4 years until someone who has the ability to really do change anything at the Fed, you know, is up for office again. I don't think we're going to see any sort of manipulation of the economy the way it's being manipulated now. So, well, I think it's a good buying market. That's what I'm thinking.
There's another issue that there was some expectations I was hearing that, you know, the European governments may be forced to sell some of their gold reserves. Yeah, basically in order to pay bills. And so there was the expectation that, you know, that was going to be flooding the market. I don't know if that's what's that's going to happen.
It would drive the price down, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So that was one theory I'd heard.
Yeah, I mean, that could also be depressing the price. And that's a temporary thing as well. I don't know if that is something that will last. That's hard to say.
Back to the Bitcoin issue, I was looking at the market capitalization chart earlier today, and it looks like it's going vertical again. So if people are thinking, oh, it's going up, I better get on board again, you might want to have a second thought, or, you know, give it another week to see what happens.
Yeah, that's a hard mistress to predict. That thing is volatile.
Well, my thing, of course, is always when it comes to currencies and investments and everything, you know, don't worry about what happens in the next week or year or even like 3 or 4 years. Like, really, you're thinking very, very long term, especially when it comes to, you know, kind of currency investments or something. Like, these are really long term trends that you're betting on, and, you know, don't be worried just because, you know, like Ron, you said you have gold, you know, don't worry about it. The long term trend is still way in your favor.
Yeah, you gotta hold out. But to be fair, most of the investment books or some of the wise men have said that long term, gold isn't really a good investment. But when there's economic uncertainty, it tends to go up for a while. You know, when people worry about currencies or governments and stuff like that, or just the market in general. And yeah, it's hard not to just put a little stuff there so you can hedge against things. I'm trying to hedge against the dollar collapse. Not that I know it's going to come, or if it will. I assume that the math works out that way, but what do I know?
Well, I certainly think it's, and the inflation is higher than they're saying it is. What, like 8% probably? They're saying it's like 2 or 3%, somewhere around there. Maybe,
yeah,
around 1-3.
It's those jerks pick a basket of things for. Because I know we're going off the deep end in terms of econ nerd knowledge, so I'll kind of explain. The way they measure, I'm sure a lot of you know, the way they measure inflation is they get what's called a basket, quote unquote, that's what the economists put together, a basket of goods. And they're saying, okay, how what's the price of this relative to the currency, relative to the dollar? And they'll throw things in there with, you know, like computers and things we know the price are going down for, and that's a way to kind of bias it down. It makes it look like the dollar isn't inflated or isn't being worthless, which is a way, you know, just more chicanery, way to trick people.
And they this one thing in really quick. They changed the way you do CPI back, I think it was in the 70s or the 80s. I think it was like in the 80s when Reagan took office, but I might be wrong about the time frame. And if you calculate with the old CPI, I know you get much higher numbers than if you calculated with the new one that the government puts out now.
Yeah, that's I think it was in the early 80s, but they're constantly changing that basket of goods. Now, if you look at the ShadowStats site, you know, it shows something much higher, but I think he's using like a fixed increment. Like, it's not based on a fluctuating or a changing basket of goods. I don't think he's really doing all the work he should be doing. You know, and I've been tempted to go back. You know, the government publishes, you know, every year, quarter, and shows what their basket is and how they evaluate it. But it's such a huge amount of data that you've got to churn through and do the calculations on. It would be like just a massive effort. And I've wondered if that would be like a good open source effort. I mean, the information is public. Could you get people to participate in recalculating and coming up with actual numbers? I would be a fun project, but I don't know. It's like another project that I don't have time for. I should also mention, I mentioned the about Bitcoin's going vertical, and I should clarify that, you know, I'm talking about the chart, and as the numbers were going higher in terms of the number, the dollar value of all the Bitcoins in circulation, it went up at a dramatic, almost a hyperbolic rate. And it's done that twice before in the history of the Bitcoins. And a big crash came after where it dropped, you know, down to like $2 a Bitcoin. So it looked like it was going vertical for a third time. And, that's kind of a tip-off signal. So,
and also, we got this question from the chat, too. Did we define vertical or what we mean that? It's a provocative term. Maybe you could explain what that means. I mean, kind of going belly up, right?
Well, it's just when you look at a chart, you know, instead of it going a nice even slope, it starts going up higher and higher and higher until you've got almost a vertical line. And, and there's basically nowhere for it to go. If time progresses to the right, the line can't keep going to the right. So it's got to go like off the top of the chart, basically. So it's kind of a tip off that some kind of crisis is going to happen. And, you know, because the acceptance or the use of Bitcoins is not increasing at that hyperbolic rate. So you wonder, well, what's going on? Is it, you know, it's basically, you know, a massive amount of buying and transactions going on. But, you know, is it really justified by the user community? You know, or is it just basically speculation? And that's what the investors got to figure out.
Yeah, and I hear you kind of when you're talking about the price and the derivative and that, you know, as it that line asymptotes, it's getting at the little bit of technical analysis, and you're bringing it back home for what that underlying value is and what the use is. Cool.
That's what I think for all investment, like, you know, underlying value and use. Look at the fundamentals. And if the fundamentals say something is good, then it's probably good. If fundamentals say something is bad, avoid it. Looking at little short-term trends, trying to predict what's going to happen next, it's a good way to get wiped out really quick.
And get heartburn and ulcers.
Yeah.
Yeah. No kidding, right? Libertarian community doesn't seem to have a lot of momentum traders. I don't know if we don't have the stomach for it, or just like you said, we're not trying to second guess that stuff. We seem to be drawn to these larger, big picture market stuff. I think that's right up our alley. Where are the general macroeconomic trends, and how can I exploit them?
Yeah, though I will say, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, getting screwed by, you know, getting in on swept up in the moment, look at the Facebook stock. Look at that. It's crashing.
Right. Yeah, that's scary.
That IPO was robbery, dude.
And just to clarify, it sounds like the people, those of us now on talking about stuff, have read a little bit or forayed slightly into investing. What I mean by momentum traders is I'm talking about day traders or people that are just trying to, you know, trade short term, get in and get out quickly and make a quick buck and just turn that stuff over. You're not even looking really into the value of stuff like Eternal's talking about. You're looking to try to second guess what everybody else is going to think of things and when what people are going to react to and how they're going to buy. I know I've talked to people even firsthand that seem to do that a lot with Apple. You know, some of these big things that are always in the news, I think a lot of people have fun trying to momentum trade that stuff. Not that I recommend it.
So you piggyback on the momentum is where the name comes from, basically.
Huh, I'm not sure I thought of it that way, but thanks for adding on. Yeah, that makes sense. It's tied to the meaning of the word from physics. That makes sense.
Yeah, so, do you want to go on to, I guess, the first article that we pulled up?
Absolutely. Who did we who we got introducing that? Who we?
And kind of, I think you had something that you wanted to share with us, right?
I sure did. So everybody who's listening and who's in here has probably at some point used Amazon to buy something for ridiculously cheap. One of the reasons that Amazon's been able to supply goods at such a cheap rate is because for a long time they were not required to pay local sales tax, and recently that's changed. They resisted it for attempts to get them to pay it for a very long time. They closed down marketing firms and other infrastructure in states to avoid the tax, but recently they signed on to an agreement which would require them to pay said tax. But what's interesting is the drive behind this sudden change in heart is that they're opening new they're opening new they're opening new
what we got?
Apologies for a second there. I had a problem there. But so they're opening
it's new warehouses, right?
New warehouses across the country to hopefully facilitate faster delivery services to the point where people are predicting same-day delivery on goods, which is pretty exciting. It's kind of the holy grail of internet shopping for a long time. And there have been a lot of attempts in the past, but they've all kind of failed. But, you know, I think if anybody can pull it off, it would be Amazon.
Definitely. I wonder, like, is this something they're looking to pilot just in the United States, or are they trying to do it worldwide at once, you know, in all sorts of European, Western countries, and maybe Australia itself?
Well, from what I can gather from the article I've read on it, it's basically they're going to be opening up these warehouses in U.S. states, and that's kind of how they're going to facilitate this fast response time and delivery. So I would think probably us here in Australia are not going to be seeing very much benefit from this. We've always had problems with, you know, delivery times. They're a lot longer here.
Yeah, I think a lot of what people don't realize, and it kind of dawned on me when I was, you know, did a Europe trip and met the swaths of Australians that are out traveling about, is that, I mean, Australia is bigger than the continental U.S. It's a huge area, and it's got the population of like Texas. There's, I mean, even if you had shipping centers in some bigger cities, there's such big areas to cover. I don't know if I could see that working.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I'm not sure where Amazon ships from when it's shipping to somewhere in Australia. I should probably look that up.
Do you get
it'd be interesting.
Do you get 2-day Prime shipping? Does that exist?
No, I'm pretty sure not. A lot of the time you'll go on Amazon, you'll be buying something, you'll say, you know, oh, you know, get free super saver shipping and stuff, and you'll click it, and it'll be like US only. So obviously we're probably
America.
Not going to see the benefit of this. Yeah, you guys get all the good shit. We just languish with our, you know, domestic shipping.
If you don't like America, you could stay out.
Well, I guess I have, so... Yeah.
Well, that's true. You're actually welcome whenever you want. If you can get past our TSA, I welcome you.
Now, I don't know if, why would you come over here, but yeah, I guess it's okay.
It's way cheaper over there.
That's true.
Stuff's way cheaper.
Excellent.
That is true.
Nintendo, do you have to use like the state monopoly shipping provider, or their private companies? How does Amazon normally ship down there?
Well, I mean, you get like three options. So you can see it within a few days, or you can see it within like a week or so, or you can wait like, you know, a month. So, you know, there's private postal services. You don't have to use the monopoly, government monopoly.
So like, which is the fastest then?
I don't know. I don't actually do a lot of net shopping. I tend to just go with the slowest option because I'm patient. So
yeah.
Can't really answer that.
So I wonder how this is going to change. You know, like I usually take the Super Saver shipping. I'm like, yeah, I'll save a few bucks if I can. If it means having to wait a couple extra days, I don't mind it so much, you know, because I'd rather not pay the sales tax. So I wonder if people will still have that option. You know, I'm up in Michigan, and I'm wondering, you know, are they going to start opening distribution centers here? Yeah, it's cool to have stuff, you know, within a matter of hours. But how, you know, if I've got to pay the same price I'm paying, you know, at the mom and pop shops, it's convenient having it come to my door. But gosh, you know, sometimes, especially for big purchases, I'd rather wait, you know, and save a few bucks. So I've not heard that discussed anywhere as to, you know, are we still going to have that option for waiting? Or is this an opportunity for another company to open up, you know, on the old model of Amazon saying, you know, okay, we'll ship this from Kansas or wherever, and it might take a little longer, but you still won't have the shipping, the sales tax.
Yeah, it sounds like from reading that article that they've kind of given up on that, the game of trying to evade taxes, much to my chagrin. And then that's the advantage they're going to push, is try to get how fast your door can they get it. Try to really cut into that in-person shopping experience. It's kind of a bummer. Personally, keeping true to the liberty-minded theme of this cast, I love kind of feeling like I'm pulling one over on the man, and when I see that checkout total and I see 0.00 for the tax, it just kind of warms my heart. So I'm kind of with you. I would, just to see that, I would rather wait the extra. I mean, what it says 2 days, but a lot of times it's there the next day. I think that's what the author of the article says. That sometimes it comes even faster. Mm-hmm. Just kind of awestruck by how that company works. And I loved hearing about their battle, and the guy and the author reiterated that you know, when they started saying, okay, we're going to tax you if you have operations there, just shut them down. Or you try to push on us with political clout, and then, okay, we have a $5 million advertising campaign or smear campaign against that law. It was such a good fight.
Mm. Well, but it's
interesting that after all this time and like really kind of really pushing hard on this whole sales tax thing and, you know, closing down huge operations in certain states to avoid it, that they've finally given in. It's kind of an interesting move.
But it's not over yet. I mean, even if they do this, you're still going to have people complaining that, oh, now Amazon's become a monopoly and they're, you know, it's anti-competitive, and because their service is so great, now it's put the other ones out of business. The other ones who don't have immediate delivery to your door and online and, you know, all this stuff available, you know. So, you know, the greater customer service is going to be calls for, oh, they're a monopoly. Now we've got to level the playing field because it's the jobs. They're going to put all these people to work, you know. So.
Sigh. Yeah, I mean, just I do my brief scan of the local news or our local newspaper. I try not to break stride as I walk past and skim the titles if I can. And they're talking about EU is having an investigation into Microsoft's antitrust stuff, and I mean that's as much as I care to know, but just, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's just another way for politicians to make names for themselves, you know, and get, you know, and the press gets into it because it, you know, it sells the newspapers. And they love, you know, picking on the corporations, especially the ones who are doing things efficiently.
All right. Do we have a caller? I think I'm just getting a note that we might have a caller. Is he in yet?
We may have a caller, and he may be on topic, or he may take us in a new direction. We'll see what happens. Oh, I love that Skype sound.
Hello.
Oh, yeah, we got someone.
Hey! You are not a caller, you're the callee. What's going on? This is the Declined Estate Internet Netcast. How's it going?
Good. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about anarcho-socialism, I guess as Reddit calls it, the real anarchism. Although that's, I don't know.
Okay. So we kind of wrapped up our Amazon topic.
Some of the people
It sounds like you're on a Zamboni right now.
Yeah, it's a little... You definitely have some background noise going on. Something.
Are you buffing your floor?
That's...
It's fine if you are. I'm impressed you can do that on your own.
I know.
if your job is to ride a Zamboni, just props for calling in during work.
No, I am at work.
Okay, all good. We can hear you loud and clear. Yeah, sorry, we're kind of stuck there because we're streaming. We want to have good sound quality. So, so not to derail you, but you wanted to talk about the quote-unquote real type of anarchism?
Well, not I consider anarcho-capitalism or voluntarism the real anarchism.
Right,
it's very difficult
that,
for me to...
Hence the quotes, yeah.
Anarcho-socialists can talk about that. Like, even reading some of the stuff on, you know, the anarchism Reddit, somebody commented on that ANCAP...
Are you a Reddit user? Do you have a username or a name for us to refer to you as?
No, I actually don't. I've just been a surfer. I haven't really made a name yet.
What should we call you then?
But Port Wolf. That's my handle, I guess. But,
awesome.
One of the things that they said that just like blows my mind is that they said the which I guess this is Marxist or whatever. I don't know what this terminology is, but they said that the employer-employee relationship is, they consider that, ANCAPs consider that voluntary, and they're crazy. And I was like, it's not voluntary? I'm not voluntarily at coming to my job every day? I don't quite understand their logic there.
Okay, well, I'm going to take a quick stab at this. From what I've gathered, like, the way they phrase things, from my experience with them, is that existence is, you know... oppression in a way. I mean, that's basically what I'm getting the idea, is that if people exist and that other people have means to make the other people not have to work as hard to exist. So, you know, let's go take this back to a tribal society or something. So you got, you know, the tribe and there's a bunch of hunter gatherers and stuff, and one guy gets a really good kill. You know, he takes down a buck or something. And, you know, he's got all this meat and stuff, but, you know, he doesn't have any obligation to share it to other people in a, you know, capitalist system, in a voluntary system. He can if he wants to, but he has no obligation to do so. He caught it himself. And, you know, what the anarcho-socialist would say is that, well, that would be oppression because he's hoarding all the capital. He's hoarding all this extra food that he can't possibly eat, and there's other people that are starving. So
that's funny, right? We want to, and that's why you want to oppress. There's like that inherent joy in it.
Yeah, not
well.
Really.
It seems impossible to have any anarcho. The anarcho part of that seems absolutely impossible. Then, because if they think that then force is justified as long as, you know, you have something that I need, besides central planning, I don't see how that's going to work. I don't see how their vision of the future. If they want to have a commune where that exists, if in a voluntary society, just have their little commune where they... But then that seems like it's going to be, I don't know, the village or some kind of scary place to live where if I have something, I have to hide it in my house.
Well, I mean, my thing, of course, is that such a system does work on a small scale. You can have just a bunch of people get together and just kind of say, we're all going to do our part and kind of pull together... You know, if someone, you know, doesn't end up pulling their own way, that's okay. Just do the best you can. and we'll make sure everyone's taken care of. That's called a family. I mean, that's what a family is. You have children.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who can't carry their own weight. You may have one head of household who takes home the bread, you know, who goes out to work every day or has their business or something. And then maybe the wife usually traditionally stays home and, you know, takes care of the kids and is more of a homemaker. Or not. But, you know, these days it's, you know, the traditional family's kind of changed. But you could have, you know,
now
more
it's
extended
state.
Families. Yeah, well, nah, yeah, that's a good point.
Now the working person is the working class.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely changed that direction. But, you know, when we talk about families, you know, we're talking about what is effectively a commune. Everyone kind of, there are rules within the family. There's you know, communication and, you know, this stuff is off limits to these people. And you know, people have rules still within the family structure, but it's mostly, you know, shared property. No one's, you know, using, you know, hopefully using violence against other people to force people from not using certain things, like... obviously, some families, that's, you know, unfortunately the case, but in a good, stable family, which most families are still, there's not the use of force to keep people, you know, in line. It's just a voluntary commune, basically. My problem, of course, is when you try to expand that out towards the greater society, you know, to a village, to a community, to a bigger community, to a city. I really, I don't know what that was, but
it sounds like a text message notification.
Yeah,
I think it was aliens.
I'm calling from
aliens.
Sorry.
I mean, when you expand that out to a greater number of people, how can you possibly maintain that kind of close family relationship with 100 million people? It doesn't work for a full society. I can't see it ever working, because the reason families work is because you get to know people very intimately. You can understand what their desires are, you can predict them better, you have a good relationship with them that's built up over time, and there's a level of trust there. Trust is something that doesn't work without a market on the large scale. I don't see it happening.
It's like Zeitgeist, they would say that there's some magic computer, which that doesn't... Anybody who's a programmer knows that the computers only do what you tell them to, so that's just another word for central planning. They have some magical computer that will, they just punch in numbers and that'll somehow work. I don't think that
makes sense. Hold on there. I work with computers and they frequently don't do what I tell them to do.
So it's a negative. Not only you tell them what to do, they might also do random things.
It's true.
There's a myth of, you know, technocracy, and it's been going on, you know, they've been predicting it for 70 or 80 years that, oh, we've entered into this era of technology and, you know, the experts will be able to figure it out. You know, and the latest incarnation is that, well, the computers will figure out pricing and distribution and production rates and who needs what, you know, but you're right. It's the computers are only as good as what they're programmed. So basically it's going to come down to some programmer or some manager somewhere saying, well, I think we need to increase production on this month, you know, so there'll be that kind of fine-tuned fiddling. And you know how well that worked for any of the command and control, you know, economies in the last several decades. It doesn't work at all.
Yeah, well, it's worse than that, too, well, because... you can go ahead and speak. That's fine.
I was wondering if... I think it may have been Hayek that one of his central points was that it wasn't so... He obviously came at a moral somewhat, but he also said that there's too much volatility in a free market for any central planner to even understand where resources need to be allocated, that the only way to effectively let resources allocate is to do them by themselves, that as soon as you try to step in, there's no way you can ever know, you know, like broken window fallacy is a good example. You have no idea what that person might have spent on if he didn't have to fix his window. So that's not even something that you could try to plug into a computer or have some bureaucrat or engineer. I mean, there's tons of smart people, and I think they think that that their idea sounds good in theory, but that there's too much information that there's no way they could tangibly, you know, plug all that in or take care of all that, and then that's, you end up, you know, really just getting sort of special interest spreading stuff around.
That's it, exactly, and you know, there's just way too many variables in it, and there's no way to predict how people are going to feel about stuff. You know, they might like Fords one day and they want GM the next day, you know, or whatever it is, the color changes. There's a new pop star pushing something, so everybody wants that. And it's impossible to predict that stuff. And to try to force people to say that, oh, well, this is the most efficient. You need to buy this. You need to wear that. It's dictatorship. You know, you've got everybody wearing the same gray outfits because somebody decided that that's the most efficient thing that people should be wearing. You know, and it's dictatorship. It's abuse. It's slavery.
It sounds like you've seen the movie Equilibrium recently.
But it also sounds like Star Trek, is what I was going to say.
Seriously, pretty good movie.
It's just like Star Trek. It's like, well, everything is kind of taken care of. It's the socialist paradise. There isn't even, like, real money. Humans don't use money in Star Trek. It's hilarious.
What is that everyone's version of the future is always some kind of socialist future? There's never any market future. That almost never happens.
There was a market future in Star Trek. It was the Ferengi. They were the ones who got it down right. Yeah, Firefly had a market.
Well, it seems like if everyone had a replicator, things would be a little bit different. But until we have a replicator that doesn't really require energy, I don't really see how you can distribute resources that way.
Yeah, they still had stuff. Like, I remember specifically, because I'm a total nerd, and this is going to absolve me of any doubt, that you know, they had to mine their fuel sources, their dilithium crystals. I remember this specifically. They had to get those. They couldn't replicate them. There were things you couldn't replicate in Star Trek. So the fact that there was no money that had to deal with those things is like, well, it's ridiculous. How do people know how to allocate it? And I guess the answer was, well, yeah, the government figured it out, which is absurd. Like, there aren't... I remember, like, the computers weren't even that smart. Like, they couldn't figure out what you were going to tell them. They couldn't figure out what, you know, commands to run or something before you opened your mouth. How the heck could they know what you wanted?
They didn't know how to love. I just want my Marilyn Monroe bot.
Oh, man.
When is that coming?
That's great.
Going across the street is pretty far from making out. Sorry.
Yeah,
I've seen way too much Futurama. Way too much. I apologize.
It's a good show. Dude, they got it right.
Yeah, well, I think trying to frame the argument to people, you know, a lot of the Occupy Wall Street, you know, people, you know, they've sort of been, you know, probably brought, I'd say in the overall picture of what Occupy Wall Street has done is probably, unfortunately, brought a lot of people to sort of the socialist thing. If somebody's, and I don't say, I'm trying not to be mean about it, but saying uneducated, but if someone's never really thought about
it before and
they
You're
showed
well
up.
Read.
Yeah, well, it, yeah, if they have never really read anything about that or never really paid attention, it's very, very easy to, with the socialist thing, say, oh, look, this is how things are and we got to make it right. And it's
course,
so easy
it's
to
more,
just
it's
say,
it's more
look,
natural that way. There's a mommy and there's a daddy. And that's something we can just, that we're all familiar with. Eternal was talking about it. There's a nice little family structure that makes sense. It's not something you have to kind of empirically put together with your brain and studying. And I heard you reference Hayek a second ago. So obviously, you know, you've put some thought into this stuff. It's, yeah, I don't think they're not getting that far in that direction, most of them.
Yeah, I mean, I did see some in some of the, you know, videos that there is somewhat of a libertarian, you know, voluntarist people trying to bridge the gap a little bit, but it seems like really, to me, the best argument sort of depends on who you're talking to. The against me argument, honestly, has woken up a lot of my friends. They don't necessarily agree with a lot of the stuff that, you know, sort of more pragmatist stuff. But the thing, I absolutely love Stefan's stuff about slavery if we get rid of the slaves tomorrow, how are we going to pick cotton? And then
exactly.
The fact that I could tell you back then, that has blown some of my friends' minds. They're like, you know what, that's a really good argument. Now they're not comfortable with then, you know, what the end means of coming to that conclusion is, you know, just yet. But I think if you're talking to someone who already has sort of like a socialist spin or anarcho-socialist, you have to sort of frame the argument into, okay, what's something that, you know, we both want? Okay, realistically, a voluntarist does not like a corporation because a corporation technically wouldn't exist. You'd have big businesses, but you would not have some special legal status in a voluntarist society. So if they don't like the power structures, quote-unquote, that exist in these corporations, I can't imagine gigantic corporations really existing. You know, I mean, there'd be bigger businesses, but realistically, businesses would have to be more efficient. They would not have, you know, tons, you know, you wouldn't have the office thing where you've got 2-3 bosses come around. They'd have to be more efficient because there's no,
big corporations,
they don't get especially government. They gotta,
big corporations like big governments. I mean, there's the same kind of inefficient bureaucracies. Like, I'm gonna give an example, you know, just
like the
for
same,
the listeners and you.
Nobody likes capitalism, or nobody hates capitalism more than a capitalist.
Yeah. Well, I was gonna say, like, you know, here's a really funny example of how inefficient these big companies are. Verizon, who, those of you who aren't familiar, is like a big telecom company on the East Coast, formed out of Bell Atlantic and some other companies. And,
big on the West Coast too.
Are they big on the West Coast now? I know they're pretty much, you know, across the entire U.S. now. I don't know if how much they're known internationally, if at all. But, you know, regardless, Verizon, you know, has so many different, you know, cell towers and so much bureaucracy. When they installed towers down in where I used to live, they had the towers running. They had the towers running with microwave links between the towers to communicate rather than running ground lines. Why? Because then the same part of the company could diagnose the towers when they didn't communicate to each other. They didn't have to call the wired guys. The wireless guys could do it all. And it was just like, it was too much of a hassle to go across the company. Imagine, you know, how it's like the same thing in government. It's the exact same thing. So imagine how, like, an even bigger conglomerate that would manage, you know, more than just like cell towers in a given area for a small part of the population. Imagine how that would function. It'd be awful. Yeah, and I think you make some really good points. I think that, you know, we have to address different people with different arguments, and I think that it's important to identify the strengths and the weaknesses of each argument as we address different people. And
well, little, you know, thing I'd like to say about this, and it's a town maybe like three-hour drive from here, in Buffalo, New York. Smaller, it's like the second largest city in New York, which isn't saying much. Obviously, New York City's, you know, vastly larger than the, you know, any other town, but they recently got some of those food trucks. You know, you can walk up and pay, and they, you know, they got all the cooked stuff right inside the truck. And it was like the first one. Buffalo's pretty small. They didn't really have anything like that before. And they were really, people were really hyped about them. You know, they're a brand new thing in Buffalo, and they were driving around, and they had this thing set up where they'd go on Twitter and they'd say, hey, there's this event going on, we're going to be there. And you know, they could park on the street, they just pay the toll, and then they can sit there for a couple hours and leave afterwards. And what happened was the local lobbying group, all Republicans, mind you, all said, oh, this is anti-competitive because we can't move our businesses around and people are coming into our businesses and using our bathrooms. And, you know, I was thinking, okay, you could just tell them no. But and ultimately they ended up, you know, with their friends in the local government passing a law that said that they could not park anywhere 100 yards from any business. They had to just park on, you know, either random streets. They had to be away from all businesses, any public bathrooms, because that was considered anti-competitive. And to me, that is just a little beautiful microcosm that I use to explain to people how big government works. It's a local version of exactly how. So if you're, you know, if you're worried about, you know, all these big companies and stuff like that, it doesn't matter if they're Republican or Democrat. They're going to end up having some buddies, and then instead of having to compete, you know, all these businesses that were, you know, maybe not losing that much business, but being annoyed or whatever from this new innovation, the food truck, instead of competing on a free market, they were able to go and use the government to make these people have to park. Now, they're still doing okay because they're popular, but to me, it's just, it's exactly the thing that was one of the things that really woke me up to, like, you know, crony capitalism, that is really something that you can bring up to people if they say, you know, oh, I hate capitalism. It's like, no, you hate this distorted, weird thing where companies are allowed to use the force of the government. That's what you're really pissed at. If they
America
just had to fend for themselves.
Again, it's pronounced America, exactly. I think you'll find.
America.
America.
Yeah, we're not capitalists. Yeah, thanks for calling in and everything. You know, I definitely appreciate the call.
Fight,
it's a great show. I mean, it's only four.
Anything you'd like to hear? Any feedback? Anything you'd like to see in the show? Any types of segments?
You guys are doing great, I guess.
Just
keep doing what you're doing. I think I'd like to see, I don't know how well that would go, is just get some people who are, you know, anarcho-socialist or some people that are, I guess, maybe a little bit closer to what we want, or maybe we can find some middle ground and try to see if we can get them to listen in. But that's
Get that one a listen. We had Redmat call in.
Yeah. Well, we also I don't think he's anarchist, so I think he's just an anarchist. But we do have a convert on the show. Nikendo came from that camp.
That's me.
I think he talked about that stuff. I think.
I'll listen after I hang up. But yeah, if you want to tell what really made that breakthrough. But thanks for taking my call, guys.
Good to know. Yeah, there's a lot of good stories amongst the cast here. So yeah, we'll try to get those out more. Thanks for the feedback.
Yeah, nice calling in, and hopefully we'll hear from you guys. Hopefully we'll hear from you again. Moving on, I know that Quash, you had something you wanted to talk about. I know.
Do we have a new
something...
caller already? Actually, before we get going,
do we have a new caller?
It sounds like we might. It sounds like we're with the hot topic right now.
All right. Well, so let's go to another caller then.
This is most exciting.
All right.
It's hard to be popular. So are we calling them again, or are they going to call us?
How are we working this?
I think we should just start calling random
there
people.
There we go. We got something.
Yeah, this is a random number dial. We'll see who picks up.
Probably pizza. She's kind of hungry.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Hello.
Oh, how's my God, you're an airplane pilot. We have such interesting jobs of our callers. Are you seriously in a wind turbine right now?
Wow, that sounds fantastic right there.
How aerodynamic are you?
Got the wind turbine?
Yeah, okay, you're through it. Nice. Hey, all right. Welcome to the Klein Estate. Care to introduce the name you go by to the listeners?
Oh, sure. On Reddit, you can find me at Liberthim. That's my screen name. And
that's where we get to if we want to flame somebody.
Yeah, if you want to flame me, if you hate me, just send me a message. Let me know.
We'll have a flame. Right, we'll start an epic flame battle. Awesome. What are you interested in talking about today?
I wanted to talk about an area of libertarian philosophy that I think fails. I think pollution, especially in the ANCAP world, would be a pretty big problem, considering what Rothbard says. He says that essentially a factory homesteads the air, or at least creates an easement when they pollute the air. And I think that's kind of ridiculous on its face, considering that you're not really doing anything to improve it. Like the common idea of homesteading.
So, what's your answer? A government entity doing things by force? What's the answer?
Well, I don't think force should be out of the question when dealing with pollution, considering that it does hurt people, and considering that...
Okay. Well, so what level of force is necessary? Just kind of equitable to any damage done to people? Any harm done?
I mean, yeah, proportional, but I mean, foremost...
What if they were to have lawsuits? What if people's rights or liberties or health or welfare or property were infringed upon? What if they were to sue or to seek grievances that way?
Well, we tried that before in the United States. And
what do you mean we tried that? We had a purely voluntary society where we dealt with things only with contracts and with nonviolence?
No, as in we settled pollution disputes with lawsuits, and we saw that, well, we really couldn't measure pollution levels as we can today. But I was just more talking about the theoretical.
So you've written off that potentiality already.
I haven't written it off. I've looked at it and I've seen that it doesn't really make that much sense.
Something we haven't tried fully won't work because it.
When was the EPA created? 1970 something.
70s, yeah.
Yeah, so we didn't.
I can look up the exact year.
We didn't have any means to deal with pollution other than lawsuits before that time, really. So
there was no laws for pollution. We didn't have a large government agency to enforce things, and was had a monopoly on force in the area.
That's besides the point. That's not what I was getting at. Anyways,
it kind of is the point, though, because
it's exactly the point.
Well, here I'll try to explain really quickly. When you have a monopoly on justice, what the problem is that when the courts fail to do their job, which is what really happened in the 1800s, the courts started to not uphold these what were called nuisance suits, which were basically, well, you're polluting on my land, therefore, you know, you're supposed to pay me something or stop, polluting on my land. And the courts used to do a decent job of that, but sometime in the 1800s, they stopped. They stopped doing it. What would happen in a free society, with market justice system, you would have people go to new courts that would actually do their job. But when you have monopoly,
how do you prove that those firms actually caused them damage if you cannot track that it exactly came from that firm?
Well, that's the question for things to be sorted out, but it's not a violent solution.
Yeah, it is something that needs to be sorted out. It's not something that you can say, oh, we'll just figure it out when it comes up.
Well, how can we sit here as four podcasters and tell you we know exactly how these things are going to be resolved in every industry that does any pollution? We can't. We are not supercomputers of the future that know everything like we were talking about earlier.
Obviously, yeah, that's true. But I'm just saying there are
Eternal might be, actually. Eternal might be a supercomputer. I haven't met him in person. It's possible.
No, I'm not even that super.
Okay. You are so super.
Nick, you had something you wanted to add to this, too, so...
Yeah, I did. As far as difficulties tracking and positively proving whether pollution was due to one particular firm, you have that problem in any situation. Unless you're suggesting that we convict people of pollution merely on hearsay. I mean...
Well, you know which firms are committing pollution and which ones aren't. It's pretty obvious to see that.
Well, then what's the difficulty in proving it?
Because you don't know which firm does the harm to which person. That's the problem. I've heard.
How do you resolve that problem in any other situation?
You prevent it from happening in the first place.
Oh no, that's not true. You can file a class action suit. You can have everyone get together and sue as a group all the polluters.
That goes against libertarian legal theory, though, because it is not proven that each one of those firms caused that pollution or caused the harm to that person.
Libertarian legal theory doesn't really... That's not a thing. I mean...
Well,
yeah,
what was I just reading earlier today that Rothbard was talking about?
Rothbard wasn't talking about libertarian legal theory. He put forth his ideas, but that doesn't mean they are the idea. And I would say that
libertarian legal theory is a thing, or outdated.
And the idea in a free society is that if there is a market for something, then it should be allowed to form. Obviously, there is a market for these kinds of suits. So, any dispute resolution organization, or DRO as we call them, would be able to hear on such a class action suit and exact their judgments, which basically come down to decreases in credit score, or what we call credit score, various other scores, reputation. And that definitely can exist in a free society if people demand it. And I think that we've just proven that there certainly is a market for this kind of thing.
Sure, there might be a market for it, but what does that entail? Like, do they get to use force to stop these people from polluting or stop them from doing what they're doing just because they may have hurt one or two people? Is that what they do?
Well, here, this is the difference. Are we talking about people who have been directly injured or killed as a result of the pollution? And then we're talking about something which is completely different. That's assault or murder rather than simply a nuisance of like, this stood on my house or something.
You're saying that we should be able to, as a society or however things work out, we should be able to prevent pollution?
We should be able to prevent excessive levels of pollution. That
who determines what excessive is?
If it hurts people,
But who determines if it hurts people? So it's not in a lawsuit, I assume, because you don't like that answer. So how does that get determined?
It gets determined by society.
So society as in a socialist society? A society that has a breathing, living, trapper, keeper, hive mind?
No, that's not what I'm talking about.
So how does that decision, you're talking about a subjective judgment. How does that occur? And I'm just trying to keep the conversation going. I'm not trying to say that you're wrong, you don't have an answer. I just don't, I mean, that's a subjective term. It's excessive amounts or hurtful. I mean, how does that get determined?
Well, everything is subjective when it all comes down to it.
Exactly. So,
this is true.
Yeah, so when there's like intersubjectivity, which is where people agree on certain things and have a certain consensus about things, people don't want excessive amounts of pollution, for example, like in urban areas.
People don't like pollution. We're all in agreement. We don't like pollution any more than you do.
Yeah.
So no disagreement there. But how do we determine that's excessive? I mean, you're saying as a society, this happens. And I know, I mean, is it like the ponytails from that Avatar movie? Is that we kind of hook into the earth and such?
I've never seen that movie, so I don't know that in that movie.
Okay, so that's a lot. Well,
yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I think that when we talk about pollution, we're talking about something that is directly damaging to people. Something that,
yes.
that causes property damage, that causes personal damage. And those are two different things. A personal damage is obviously far more severe, and that can lead to charges of things like, it's not just vandalism, we're talking about murder or assault or, we're talking about very serious personal liability. I remember in a free society, companies are not free from this kind of liability. They don't have the shield called the Limited Liability Corporation.
It's just that you can't prove which company did which damage to any given person. It's literally impossible to figure that out. Unless what I have heard some libertarians suggest is that the insurance companies would require some type of tracking agent to be put in the pollutants. So you could know which firm is causing damage to which person. I'm not a scientist. I don't know exactly how that would work. But what I do know is that all you would need is two firms to not have that tracking agent. And it would make it impossible to figure out which firm it came from. And you would thus be prosecuting an innocent firm for the damage caused to a person when...
Well, then they would put a tracking agent in their stuff. Like, if they get accused of having, something to do with the pollution, and they're not using a tracking agent, that means that, well, they can't prove their innocence. They would want their insurance.
Their
company would want to have a tracking agent so it can prove their innocence. Think about it.
You don't have to prove your innocence. You have to be proven guilty.
That's not true, necessarily. Remember, private law. It just has to be something that people reasonably decide upon.
Guilty until proven innocent. That is the entire reason why people like freedom, is because they're not guilty until proven innocent. That would defeat the whole purpose.
All right, well, I think we've kind of touched on this in a lot of different ways.
Moving on.
Thanks for calling in. We do want to get this moving on to the next topic. Not to say that this wasn't a great conversation, but we're already at an hour mark, so I think pollution's
a good topic.
I think it's a great topic, and I think that you hit. I think you hit on an absolutely fantastic idea with the tracers and pollutants. I think that we need to think about ideas like that, which are technological solutions, rather than always resorting to well, we can always just stick guns in people's faces. Like, of course we can do that. That's a quote-unquote solution for everything. You know, that's... It's really, really hard to continue to, you know, have you know, a conversation and to move forward as a society when you're too busy just saying, well, we'll just stick guns in each other's faces and that will solve the problem. We need to think outside the box. We need to have more innovative solutions like the ideas of tracers and pollutants.
Yeah, I mean...
I know you had an article that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, and I think it touches on this. You know, a lot of people will say, well, you know, we need to look beyond ourselves for help. We need to look to the stars. There's an article in the Daily Mail that talks about a presentation at the Euroscience Open Forum in Dublin. And I don't know who this group is. I don't know what their funding is. And they mention how leading scientists say that it's a matter for governments rather than Hollywood who should start preparing for our first extraterrestrial encounter now. You know, it's the government that's got to do this. We can't leave it to individuals to contact with outer space beings. You know, the only government can handle these problems. So this speaker, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, said, I do suspect that we are going to get... Now, listen to her scientific statement here. I do suspect that we are going to get signs of life elsewhere, maybe even intelligent life, within the next century. And how prepared are we, the article asks. And, I don't know. Maybe there was more detail, scientific detail that was absolutely or actually... you know, brought into this presentation, but, you know, how scientific is this? Somebody speculating that, oh yeah, we're going to get contact from alien life, and it sounds more like a wishful thought. Professor Bell said, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, so you're probably talking of conversations that could take 50 or 100 years just one way. I guess she's thinking that, you know, we'd send them a message, and they'd send one back, and eventually they'd show up here, and they'd, you know, bring us their wisdom. And a poll of more than 2,000 men and women for the Royal Society found that 44% are of the opinion, I'm sure these were all scientists they asked, that extraterrestrial life exists, and more than a third of those questions said we should be actively searching and trying to make contact with ET. Makes sense, doesn't it? But scientists are divided whether we should be advertising our presence to inhabitants of other planets. Some say that if we are alert, hostile aliens to our existence, we risk an invasion that could lead to the end of life on Earth. Boy, you know, I guess we should, you know, be spending money to defend ourselves from this alien risk. They even quote Stephen Hawking here. You know, what is there a bigger name in science now that Carl Sagan's gone? So he warned that aliens may plunder the Earth for its resources and its women, too, I guess, and advocating that we do everything we can to avoid contact. He said we only have to look at ourselves to see how intelligent life might develop into something we wouldn't want to meet. It's that collective guilt again. And, you know, he said if aliens visit us, the outcome would be as much as when Columbus landed America, which didn't turn out so well for the Native Americans. Ah, yes, that collective guilt. Eternal, what do you have to think about this?
Oh, yeah, well, I was just going to say, you know, we clearly need to spend all our money that we don't have on building, you know, this huge planetary defense structure, just like Paul Krugman's suggestion. Just, you know, that's important for growth, and that'll spur the economy into good shape.
Well, you know, but how do we know that they're even good? You know, the movies are always depicting, well, half the time they're depicting the aliens as being, you know, an invading force. They want to, like, eat our cows or turn us into, you know, robots or something.
Our cows are delicious. You know,
well, that's something we have. They just want to eat the testicles and their eyeballs, you know.
That's great. We can make so much money selling them testicles and eyeballs. We don't want those parts, except for people in Montana.
Yeah, start a whole industry for that. Yeah, but, you know, or the other viewpoint is, you know, the aliens are altruists, and they want to come and bring us a cure for cancer. They want to help us and show us how to be loving and develop into a free society that doesn't pollute, you know, and we just love each other, you know. But, you know, wouldn't it be funny, though, if the real thing when the aliens show up is if they were ANCAPs? And, you know, and they didn't even want to deal with government because they hate governments and they just wanted to trade with people, you know. They'd be like, oh, here, give us the cow testicles and we'll give you some helium-3 because you guys could really use it. You know, so I'd love to see a movie like that. I think it'd be hilarious, you know. So
it would be great. It'd be like, you know, quite frankly, the closest thing that's ever existed, as far as I know, in popular science fiction has been like the Ferengi or something in Star Trek. I don't know of anything else that's been like a traitor civilization that's all about, you know, we're not going to discriminate against anybody. We'll take profit from everybody. Though they had a government, but it was pretty much a government that was completely about profit anyway. I don't really understand too much about what they did.
Well, the writers probably don't understand capitalism so much. You know, it's like in the movies in many movies when they show business deals going on, you know, or business meetings, it's all like really artificial and plastic because, you know, the writers of the screenplays and probably most of the directors and producers, you know, they don't know anything about how real business, you know, especially like manufacturing business and that kind of stuff really goes on. You know, so it's all like plastic and phony, just as the way they don't understand, you know, science and aliens and economics either. So we always get this warped view, and the people take it in. You know, the people aren't getting the science by reading Stephen Hawking's book on time. You know, they aren't reading
time.
The Brief History. They, you know, it was a popular book, and you know, a lot of people did read it, but. You know, more people got the summaries they read in the newspaper. They read the little clips. They hear Stephen Hawking. Well, I guess he doesn't say it anymore, but, you know, that he types out, it gets said for him. You know, but they get these little bits and pieces that's filtered for them. So it's no wonder that people are saying, well, yeah, 44%. Yeah, we all need to be spending money to protect, to contact ET and to make us safe from that. Here, government, take some more money. Well, take somebody else's money so that you can build its defenses. And that's the way that the public gets manipulated.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. Yeah, it's a pity, too, because Stephen Hawking's books are pretty good. And they're easy to read. Everyone should read them.
Yeah. I read it, you know, many years ago now. But
I've read all of his stuff. I've read, let's see, Universe in a Nutshell, A Brief History of Time. There was a couple more. There was one he released recently that was kind of just a recap of physics up until now. I can't remember the name of it to save my life.
Was there a lot of politics in his books?
No, not really. He very rarely makes any sort of analogies outside, you know, science and maybe, you know, something that people all know, you know, baseball or something like that.
Well, see, now it has been a really long time since I read Brief History of Time, but it seemed to me there were like philosophical implications about, you know, the great value of science and trusting scientists kind of stuff. I'd probably have to go back and look again. But I seem to have a recollection that there were philosophical implications by what he was presenting in there.
Well, I certainly think there's philosophical implications if aliens come to visit Earth. I mean, there's been so many movies of it and, you know, so much discussion. Like Contact, have you ever seen that movie? I mean,
yeah,
it's all about
that was,
like... Yeah, it's a big topic in pop culture, and we think that, you know, aliens are going to come to Earth, it's going to change everything. It's going to change, you know, the way the entire world works. It's going to topple regimes. It's going to, you know, unite everybody under one unified government, something like that. And
right.
What it probably will be like, and I completely agree with you, is it's just going to be some people show up, and they're like, what's this strange rock with these water sacks walking around in their strange, you know, dinosaur-powered machines, and they go down and they see, oh, well, they got, you know, cow testicles, so it's pretty delicious, so let's go and trade for them.
And you're referring to oil as dinosaur, squash dinosaur juice?
Yeah, dinosaur juice, that's the term I was thinking of.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what we are. Water sacks. I think that these scientists are referencing, or the author of this article is a little bit optimistic about this encounter with aliens, because the most intelligent creatures on our planet are always predators, because they have to anticipate and figure out the actions of what they're going to eat. So whatever leaves another planet, I feel like is pretty much guaranteed to be a predator that's going out to predate. And that's what it'll come to when they see us, if they do.
Well, yeah, but I wonder because, you know, I mean, I think I'm starting to learn that, you know, society is evolving. You know, I mean, we've come from, you know, from tribal to feudal to monarchical to, you know, semi-republican / democratic forms of government. And I think the next step in evolution is a voluntarist setup, you know, and something lacking government. You know, if that's a natural progression, why wouldn't we expect that of other races as well?
Well, we could have that progression, but even us, right? We could have that progression to ANCAP, but we would still be eating meat. We would still be predators in that sense.
Well, yeah, but so wouldn't we expect that of other intelligent beings too?
The question is that like a hard and fast progression? I mean, just because it's happened with humans doesn't even mean it's a sort of natural progression for humanity, let alone a creature which would probably think in a completely different way about everything. So I don't think you can really speculate on whether that is a natural progression or not. I do think that probably a society that was more voluntary would be wealthier and would generally have greater cultural output. So I do think there are reasons why species we met from, you know, outer space would tend to probably be fairly peaceful. But I don't think it's by any stretch a hard and fast rule. And I don't think the history shows it necessarily a progression towards more liberty and less violence.
But don't you think that reason and logic are universal? I mean, if they're regardless of their background, their history, their experiences, their strangeness of their world, logic itself is universal. And I would suggest that, you know, it's logic that leads us toward treating each other fairly and trading with each other on an even basis, not just because the effects were positive for us because of our unique situation.
I agree with that. I think that certainly that's been a goal of a large number of Earth philosophers, to say, well, if we apply logic and reason, you know, we can determine, you know, the best way for us to coexist and the best way for us to interact with each other. And it turns out to be voluntary interaction and things that libertarians, you know, refer to as the non-aggression principle and some form of property rights. And the idea that, you know, free markets are the best way to allocate resources. These things, you know, have their origin in, you know, sound principles and logic and reason. They're not just cultural constructs.
Well, and however you get there, too, if you come to this society or this organization of society based on logic or reason, if that's the motivation, that would make sense. I could buy that, too. But assumingly, this is the, you know, if we're correct or if we understand things the way we think we do, this is a lowest energy state for a system, a biological system. It's the least conflict, the least negative interactions. Maybe the most stable. So maybe I guess that's what I think it was Quash, right? You're saying that might motivate that idea of a greater trend for all planets to go in that direction. Not that I'm saying that I think that's definitely the case, but
it's, gotta give her that negative energy, man.
Certainly a certainly a good thought experiment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's something that I hadn't thought about in the past, probably because of the media influence, you know. But yeah, the more you think about liberty and how it makes sense, you would think everybody ought to think that way, even people on different worlds.
Well, I certainly think that, you know, one thing is true as it was back in, you know, the 1960s and 70s when we were first launching spaceships out, you know, past Earth orbit, when we were launching like Voyager 1 and 2, which is that mathematics is universal. And, you know, there are certain mathematical principles. If you represent them like a sequence of prime numbers or Fibonacci sequence or something. You know, these patterns can be picked up by any intelligent life that it has the ability to recognize those basic patterns. And, you know, that should be a means of communication. You go down to the fundamental objective truth, which is mathematics, reason, and logic.
Yeah, that's what they put on the Voyager spacecraft. They figured, well, yeah, they're not going to understand our language. They may not even make sense of the pictures we could put on there. But if you could put mathematical symbols, you can make them start to understand, you know, start with numbers and then, you know, somehow work that up into idea units and pictograms and eventually get to language so they'd be able to understand the rest of the stuff we sent up on there too. But yeah, it's mathematics, which is based in logic. And you'd think that anybody capable of intercepting a spacecraft or of intercepting our signals coming out, you know, would have that kind of ability to make sense of what we're talking, again, based on mathematics and logic.
Or they could just have really good taste in Earth culture and just be like, yeah, these guys got it down. You know what they really could come out for more than anything else, especially this time of year? Summer steam sale.
Oh my god.
There's a transition.
Yeah. So we were also going to talk about the summer steam sale. Yeah. Go on.
That's true. Yeah, let's bring it up. So as Eternal smoothly transitioned to it, I have a topic to discuss, which is the summer steam sale. And the reason I want to discuss it, not only because it's topical, but also because in my IRL, in my everyday life, I found it's the best way to bring up voluntarist concepts and concepts of non-violence or non-coercion of the state, and also just kind of general disdain for IP laws and FBI enforcement and stuff like that. The Steam sale, if you're not already on there buying up games you're not going to play, has just covered, I guess, for what, 8 days straight of just games that are 75% off by all reduced by our Lord and Savior Gabe Newell, which is the iconic Valve creator and owner.
Praise be his name.
Praise be his name. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, there's my brother introduced me to just the plethora of fan user videos and joking things which both treat him as God and berate him for not releasing Half-Life 3 yet. But I mean, these things are brought to people, mind you, that know how to pirate things and download these things for free, but it makes it so much easier and so much cheaper at 75, 90, 80% off, et cetera, et cetera. You can buy big packets, you can buy 4 packs and give gifts to all your friends. And we're not doing advertising for this. It's just a great kind of market answer to IP laws. Sorry, I'm looking at the chat. I'm like, yeah, the second person today to get distracted by the chat.
That's okay. Yeah. No, I definitely think that when it comes to Steam sales, the greatest thing is that we've reached a point where there's so much entertainment out there. People have provided so much content for us to enjoy that you're looking at it and you're like, wow, I can afford to buy every single thing here. I could buy every game. I could literally afford to buy every single game put out in Steam sale. No problem. Is that cheap? And that'd probably be, at the end of the sale, something around like 100 games. Like, no problem. That would probably cost me a couple $100.
More.
That's not
there, there was a list on Reddit Gaming, I think, of all these ones that are unadvertised or secret ones, and it was a list that our nice fellow Reddit users made an alphabetical order with links to the Metacritic site, and there was like 80 more of those, and I just don't understand. There's just so much crap.
Yeah, well, there definitely are some hidden gems that aren't getting a front page advertisement, but yeah, there's so many games out there, but they're so cheap that you can actually afford to buy most, if not all of them. Like, it's not a problem for somebody who makes any real money whatsoever. So for someone like me, I have a job. I can afford to buy all these things, but I can't play them.
You don't have the time.
I could not play all these in the year. I couldn't do it. There's no way. There are so many games out there that I have to pick and choose based upon what's the best one. Which one would I rather spend my time on? And, you know, it's crazy that we're so inundated with choices on how to be entertained that, you know, we can be this, you know, decadent and be like, oh man, I would buy these awesome games. They're rated so well, but I don't have time to play them, man. I'm too busy playing these other games, which are rated even better.
Yeah, and the thing I love is that it's the producers or the sellers have found a way to monetize this. They bring it to your doorstep in a package, in this, you know, a user interface where you can give people other games, you can message people. I didn't really dive into it head first until the sale happened, and it kind of brings you in. You know, granted, I know as well that I can't play all these games, but. When I bring it up with people, I just kind of point out gingerly that, hey, look at this. They give you a good product that's competitive, and they make you want to buy it. And conversely, I don't want to steal it because, okay, if I buy it this way, I can play it on Steam. It's a better interface. It's cheap enough that I don't really care. And there's no warning in the beginning of a multi-$1,000 fine and FBI raids at my house or some violent way to enforce this. There's a peaceful solution, and it's providing a better product. And it's similar to what iTunes did with giving music, and Steam seems to have done it with video games. So kudos. Yeah. And I recommend Saints Row 3, that game. That's the one that sucked me in for a few days. It's like Grand Theft Auto, but more ridiculous. Cause
my roommate was playing that back when I was in college.
The third one? I guess it's been out for a while, huh?
Yeah, the third one. I mean, I think he got it like not in a Steam sale. I don't know.
So is this like the real reason our GDP has dropped so much? Everybody's playing games all the time?
Probably. I mean, what do people actually do in IT? I mean, I'm not in IT, but, like, what do people actually do? Because, you know, how long does it really take to tell somebody, turn it off and on again? Now, do you see the screen? Okay, plug your computer in before you turn it on again.
You'd be surprised how long it can take to tell somebody how to do that stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm just playing.
Yeah.
But definitely, I mean, you could be in the background playing, you know, like some game or something. Playing SimCity.
You could set up an automatic machine to just give canned responses. 9 times out of 10, you'd probably be able to fix their problem that way.
It's true. And then the other 10%, like, you just get your supervisor, just be like, I cannot handle this, and let me get you to a supervisor. They kind of already have replaced a lot. Like, have you guys ever called into, you know, technical support at like a phone company, like for Verizon, for instance? Like, it's all automated up to a very, you know, large point. Like, there's a lot of automated help in these systems now because it really is just that easy. Unfortunately, if you have a real problem, you're sitting there mashing zero, like, operator, I want to talk to a person.
The only time I ever need to call the frickin' ISP is when I've got a real problem. So, yeah, not the best for me. Although I think there is a shortcut for that. You can hold down a button and it'll usually get you through, but...
Yeah, usually it's... I mean, America, it's zero for operator. I don't know if it's different than Australia.
I usually just pray to Gabe Newell and hope that he'll fix things for me.
That usually does it. Yeah, I found.
He rides in on his sleigh and showers you with bags of Steam gifts.
Gabe is a good Gabe.
I don't know. I think he might be, I think he actually like is Santa Claus. Like literally, he's Santa Claus. Just, you know, every day that's not Christmas, he's not up the North Pole. He's at Valve, and then he's making all the toys. And it's actually all elves. Like, I've never actually met any that's worked at Valve, so I can't verify the veracity of this statement. But I think they're all elves, and they just work in the workshop making toys for us. True story.
You may have made it up, but it's also true. That's the magic of Gabe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, anybody who's, if you're into games, you know, go check out the Steam Summer Sale. Go look at all the ridiculous nerd candy that's out there.
And if you're into spreading the message of liberty, point that out to people that it's not necessary to use force to get people to give people incentive to make games. People will make things, people will create, and people will sell them, and we'll have more stuff. Just take a breath, everyone.
Yeah, it's
the
great.
The market in action.
And there's one more thing I wanted to hit on. I guess we're kind of hitting the hour and a half mark here, but one more thing I wanted to hit on before we go is
this
one
a
more
lady?
Article. No.
No article, okay.
Yeah, no, it's just a quick article. Because we were talking about, you know, IP, and we're talking about piracy. This one thing that Steam has kind of prevented through a market, you know, approach by just making things so cheap and readily available and good that people don't really pirate that much. You know, why pirate when you can get a game for $2.50 on Steam sale? But, you know, there's something in the Philippines. There's a bill that is being introduced in the Philippine House of Representatives who would penalize people who illegally download with a minimum 2-year jail sentence and fines of 50,000 to 150,000 Philippine pesos. I've absolutely... Oh, okay, that's $1,200 to $3,600. So that's a lot of money, especially for someone who's living over there. Philippines is a pretty poor place. People are not well off in the Philippines for the most part. If you're not politically connected, I mean, you probably are living well below the U.S. poverty line. So $1,200 to $3,600, that's a lot of money. And you know, it says here, piracy is theft of intellectual property and is no more justifiable than shoplifting, said Representative Erwin Chiang, who introduced the bill. The damage done to the entertainment industry and legitimate end users do not outweigh the few advantages that piracy does have. And of course, this is complete bullshit, because piracy is not theft. It's not theft.
It doesn't exclude the original owner of something.
It's
so
like
if I take something from your store, it's gone and you can't sell it. But if I copy something, it's copied, which means we each have an equally good copy of something. It's completely different.
It's like Grand Theft Auto, except your car's still there. And
exactly.
It's just two cars. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's not theft. It could be a quote-unquote indirect theft of sales, potential sales from a person, but you can never know for sure that a sale was lost because something was pirated. I know for a fact that many people... that I know personally, who I will not name names in case the FBI is listening to this cast.
Billy Corbin.
Yeah. Pizzly Bear. Yeah. Yeah. So guys like Pizzly Bear, they go and download movies or games or something, and they're not actually going to go out and buy them. They would never have done so, but they're going to check it out anyway. And, this isn't a lost sale. It's just someone who's curious about the product. And maybe if they do like it, they will spend money on the next product. I know I've done this with music, personally. I mean, I've done this with artists that, non-American artists, artists that probably people won't know. But this is a good way for a lot of underground bands who are not in the mainstream music community to get their music out there. They like their stuff to get pirated because... Well, what happens? People go and take a look at it, and they're like, oh, man, this stuff is great. Let's go see these guys in concert when
Let's
they come
Let's go
through.
See them in concert, exactly.
Let's buy their T-shirts. T-shirts, man. T-shirts are the way the bands make money. They make a lot of money in T-shirts.
Do they? Yeah, I mean, and going to shows, too. I mean, heaven forbid people that produce intellectual property should have to earn a living like the rest of us by actually showing up somewhere and working and playing their music. It just seems kind of... It seems kind of scary to me that they can just make something once and just hang out and rest on their laurels and keep getting a constant stream of money come out while the rest of us have to work. Not that I'm bitter, but...
No, you don't sound
bitter at all.
I was going to say, most musicians actually perform and do the music thing because, well, they like the music, they like being part of the community, they like performing, they like writing music, they like producing art, but they don't do it for the money. They definitely don't do it for the money.
Of course
and
not.
And that would be... That's the same with IP laws or without IP laws. Most... The people that benefit from the IP laws are the major studios. They're the major industry players. They're the people who are politically connected. You know, we're talking about, like, EA games. We're talking about the major music studios that get all the radio airtime.
We're talking about like Universal Studios or Disney or something. You know, the big name movie studios that, you know, are spending millions and millions, yeah, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on like Ghost Rider or some other god awful movie that flops entirely. I don't even know how they afford to make these movies. Like, this is the only reason they're so crazy about IP is because they're desperate for profits. I mean, they need money because they can't sell their crap. It's so bad. But, you know, rant over.
Rant ended. Well, got a couple of good rants in there.
If I can't, don't miss the point in this article that the bill that was introduced by this representative Tang, he said the damage done to the entertainment industry and legitimate end users does not know what you read that. But his uncle is Wilson Tang, CEO of Filipino entertainment conglomerate Solar.
Of interest there.
Yeah, really, really. You know, but isn't that the same case? You know, maybe they're not, you know, related so closely in this country, you know, but they're related by dollars. You know, the entertainment money is flowing into Congress, and they introduce this legislation, you know, which is designed to be, you know, protect the industry and protect the children and whatever else it needs to do. You know, so. You know, so it's all being done in the name of protecting somebody or else, you know, while we stomp on your rights and prevent you from exchanging, you know, what's already in your legal possession. Well, should be legal.
Well, I certainly think that, you know, people who produce intellectual, what we call intellectual property, so, you know, something that's information rather than a physical thing, they're still providing value. They can still sell it. They're still creating something that we care about. It's, yeah, as James Carlin calls it, intellectual wealth. And I definitely agree with that. You know, if I write a book, I'm creating wealth, you know, and I can sell that to people. But the whole point of the property, of the intellectual property laws and of this copyright nonsense is that, well, just because you produce something means you get to have an absolute monopoly on, you know, how it's distributed. You get to use the guns of the state to reap as many profits as you possibly can, especially out of people who, you know, are completely nonviolent.
Absolutely. And the main thing I was taking issue with is saying that stealing something off a shelf, an actual physical object, is not tantamount. It's not the same thing as making a copy of something, which is not to take away that. I agree with what James says, that it is intellectual wealth that is created. There is value there, certainly. And that can be enforced with contracts and stuff like that, but it's not the same as, you know, making an actual physical object, I guess, in a sense.
I mean, if you can steal a book, I mean, you're not. It's different between stealing the words on the page. You can't steal the words on the page; they're just things. You can copy them as much as you want. It doesn't destroy the, you know, original words, but you can definitely steal a book. So if you are, you know, for instance, if you're a book. If you're a book publisher, or if, you know, if you're an author especially, who's just publishing his own work, you know, you want to make sure that you get everything out there at once. You want to make sure there's no leaks. So you might want to sign non-disclosure agreements for anyone who gets to read it in advance and review it or something. And you want to make sure that, you know, when it gets out there, that everyone knows it's a legitimate copy and that it gets distributed to as many places as possible. And then you'll reap as many profits as possible, and then, you know, time will go on, and maybe people will come up with some cheap knockoff copies if it sells really well and it's worthwhile doing. And everyone will know it's crap, you know, like the fake Rolexes. Everyone knows that fake Rolexes are terrible. They're not Rolexes, but people make them anyway, and people buy them anyway. It's a different market. And, you know, they can coexist just fine. You know, your cheap knockoff books or something, or, you know, your online books and the real deal, which is something that looks good in a library or a collection. And, you know, the author doesn't really, you know too much of a difference at that point. He's already made the bestseller list. He's gotten out there. And people know that it's legitimate work, and he could sell the next one. You don't need to have this monopoly on the work for, what, 50 years for some of these things? Is that how long, like, some of these copyright monopolies are on for, 50 years? I think like Disney has it on their movies, it's like 50-year
patents or copyrights.
I thought copyright's like 100 years now. I'll have to look it up, but yeah, I'm thinking
it might be.
It keeps changing, you know. It's shifting every time the IP on Mickey Mouse is almost up.
Right, right.
It just gets shifted. Strange coincidence.
Yeah.
And, I mean, apparently with Star Wars and stuff, they just keep re-upping the lease almost. I don't know if they're lobbying or what, but that should have been up a long time ago, and now it's way into the future, is my understanding.
Is the thing, like, this stuff is way old. You know, it's generations old. Why the heck are there still, you know, these intellectual monopolies? Why are people still threatened with the guns of the state? And who are going to take their money away or throw them in jail if they copy these things, when all the original producers of the works are retired or dead. Like, Walt Disney is so beyond dead. He's beyond worm food dead. He's gone. Who cares about Mickey Mouse? He's not the one reaping the profits. You know, the original people that came up with these concepts are not the ones reaping the profits anymore. It's just executives that sit there, you know, rolling in their bed of cash that they're getting because they have intellectual monopoly.
Yeah, absolutely. They're Scrooge McDuck towers that they can sense every last coin in it because that's who they are.
I like Scrooge McDuck, though. He has a money pool. I would dive in that shit. I would swim in it naked. I'm skinny dipping.
Would he let you? I can't remember if any of those old DuckTales or if they'd ever had guests over. That was probably Swingers night.
Dude, wow. You're ruining DuckTales for me.
Yeah. I'll never be able to get that image out of my mind.
That's only when Launchpad comes over.
Oh, man. Yeah, I think you're killing the cast. All listeners are just like turning it off.
What
like,
are you
I don't
doing?
Want to hear anymore.
There's one listener in the archive a couple months down the road who's going to enjoy that.
It's probably be like your mom or something.
Yes, it's going to be my mom.
and you're going to feel bad.
No, I made her happy. I thought you were talking about how important the family unit was.
All right. Yeah, do we have any more articles that anybody wanted to share? I thought there was like maybe one more
We had more. I'm curious who the presenter was. If we want to get to that or start to wrap, we're getting around the 90-minute mark.
Well, we're past the 90-minute mark.
We've got the useless airports in Spain, the nanoparticle to cure, I think, hepatitis something, and the Google project to preserve dying languages.
You want to talk about the last one? I know that's something that you wanted to talk about really quick.
Yeah, and I suppose it's good because it's quite a quick little thing. So, or we could have a caller.
I don't know. I thought we had a caller there for a second. Oh, actually, there's something we definitely should do is see if IRC has any questions. Any questions from IRC?
Yeah, good point.
We haven't taken any IRC questions in a bit.
No questions from IRC, apparently.
Oh, that's embarrassing.
Yeah, that's great, though. Let's talk about this Google project to preserve, I guess, dying languages.
Yeah, so I recently read in an article that Google has unveiled a new online project, because they do love their online projects, to save more than 3,000 endangered languages. From what I can understand, the website is endangeredlanguages.com.
3,000?
Yeah, 3,000 endangered languages.
I didn't even know there were that many languages in the world. I mean, insane.
I mean, we've got hundreds here in Australia alone.
I guess they're all the Aboriginal native languages.
Yeah, you got all those stuff like Ainu in Japan, which has about 100 and something speakers at this point. So, you know, there's quite a few endangered languages. 3,000 would not cover even a small percentage, I would think, to be realistic. But basically, from what I can gather from this article, and it's a rather short article, The project's goal is to collate and streamline the sharing of materials for learning a variety of, you know, obscure minority languages. A map on the project's website highlights thousands of languages, including Noete in East Timor, Aragonese in Spain, Maori in New Zealand, and more than 200 in Australia.
I think it's definitely, it's a cool project. I mean, it certainly doesn't hurt anybody, you know, these days of massive data storage. If you can get it all together, if you can actually pull this off and save a lot of these languages, it will be kind of cool to have them around. Though I'm not sure how many people will care other than maybe like linguistic anthropologists or something.
There are linguist nerds to the extent that we are econ nerds. I'm a little bit of one too. There's people that go around. I've seen documentaries where they go to find these last remnants of languages where there's like a handful of speakers in their 80s and 90s. You know, parts of South America, Russia, India, where there's many, many, many languages because of, I guess, because all the people. But
there are a lot of Indians.
There are certainly a lot of them. What's interesting to me is I guess I don't know if you know this, Nintendo, from the article, but there's, I guess, different visual representations, and for Google's task they're charged with is how to do this phonetically and also kind of code out or make new character systems.
Was that a question?
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of posing it to the group, but in terms of, or you know, just maybe a curious rant, but how is Google planning to store all that? They have all the different, you know, if it doesn't fit in a Roman character set.
The project is, as far as I can understand, it's to facilitate learning materials that already exist. So for a lot of these languages, you probably don't even have, you know, Unicode characters or anything. So you're probably going to see a lot of scanned pages and, you know, video and audio material getting circulated more than anything else. But obviously it would depend on the language itself. I mean, some of these languages don't have writing systems. Like I don't think Australian Aboriginals ever had a writing system until you know, colonialists came along, and now I assume they use Roman letters to write their language, but I don't even really know, to be honest.
That would make sense. They do have the famous cave paintings with lots of dots and colors.
So, you know, a lot of these languages are probably so obscure that they don't actually have an official written script. I know Ainu is not, even though it's fairly well known, it technically doesn't have a proper writing script in terms of computer input. You have to change font sizes on your computer when you're writing in one of the Japanese scripts constantly if you're going to write proper Ainu. So
that's a pain. Be easier to write it with like a tablet PC or something.
Yeah, so I think you're going to see a lot of handwritten materials.
Yeah, so scanning it up.
I was going to say, you know what language I would really like to see preserved? Like, I'm familiar with a dying language too. I would like to see them put Fortran in there.
Nice.
Fortran. I think it's important to preserve those languages. What's the other one? Some really, really old languages. Trying to think of other things.
What I want to know is, are they going to preserve all the dialects and all the accents spoken all over this country? Where are they going to store all that stuff? Who's going to keep all that?
This is alternate Quash or bizarre Quash. He's one of our favorite show characters.
So, no, but seriously, I want to, you know, who's valuing this thing? You know, I've been hearing about this for years, how all the languages are disappearing. We've got to save money to preserve them and document everything. And, you know, it's always government or, well, university, which is ultimately government money, you know, to preserve this stuff. But, you know, I want to ask again, who is valuing it? If we say that the language has value, to whom? And it's to, well, the people.
Ultimately,
that,
people, right? Yeah.
Well, yeah, but so let the ones who value the language, let them preserve it, you know?
Well, Google's
stepping up to let them do the heavy lifting, and they're just providing the storage, I guess. Yeah.
They're providing a service to facilitate people who want to preserve these languages. They're providing a service so that they can share the materials.
Oh, well, yeah, now that's great. I mean, if they're providing a service for people to use, I mean, that's something that's not been around. I mean, there's not been an easy way to record it, you know, or make sure that it can be preserved. You know, so obviously that's a good thing. But, you know, whenever I hear this stuff, it's always like, you know, somebody's got to pay for this. Somebody's got to do the documenting, you know, and it's coming out of somebody else's pocket usually.
So somebody is code for not me.
Right, right,
yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah, well, this is the beauty of this initiative is, for really the first time ever, you're seeing a concerted market-based effort to preserve what a lot of people considered the domain of, you know, government cultural preservation.
Yeah, what is that, Nintendo? I thought the big corporate people were the evil ones, and they're always stepping on the little guy every chance they get.
Yeah, well, there you go. You know, I'm sure that Google has some hidden agenda here where they're going to use the power of obscure language to conquer the world. But, you know, it's really great to see.
I'm okay with Google conquering the world. It'll be so easy to find anything. Like, think about it. If you wanted something, you'd be able to find it. Just like, you know, you just say it out loud and be like, bam, it's there. You know exactly where it is.
So when those space aliens arrive, they wouldn't see a big water-filled planet with us water-bagged people, but they would just see a search bar, a giant search bar.
Pretty much. We'll just put up a big banner between two satellites, and it'll just be like, you know, Google. And, you know, they just type stuff in or something. It'd be great.
Did any of you guys see Galaxy Quest?
No.
Man, that's been so long. That was Tim Allen, right? Yeah, Galaxy Quest was great.
I remember a robotic boner sound.
Yes, I have. Yes.
I remember a robotic boner sound.
I don't know about that, but the basic premise was that the alien civilization was watching all of our TV shows and thinking that that was like reality. So they came up here, you know, expecting, you know, a world based on television, because they had no sense of humor at all. And, you know, so like they thought Gilligan's Island was true, and they thought that it was so sad that those people were stuck on the island for so long. And that was their perception of us, you know. So I guess we have to be careful what we send out and what we document, you know, for the alien cultures to review, too.
That's true. Actually, that's really funny. If we ever came across, like, an ancient alien civilization that was, you know, long gone, you know, and what would we come across? It would probably be all, like... Quite frankly, if they stored their stuff digitally, it would be like 90% porn. It'd be alien porn. Like, think about it. It's like us. Yeah. So that's how would we? It'd be really hard to find without, you know, an alien Google. You know, the real legitimate stuff, the stuff that really matters.
And it's like those cave paintings in France too. You know, they always have that. You know, the buffalo. You know, it's probably the same thing going on there. They've. You know, that was the earliest form of recorded communication. That was probably porn too, you know.
Yeah, probably.
Those Aboriginal cave paintings, they're really just porn.
It's true.
Just haven't figured that out yet.
But I don't feel bad about whacking off to them because, you know, now that I know, you know, that makes sense.
You're connecting with history there.
Yeah, it's true. At a deep emotional, visceral level and an animal level.
You see what you get when you make it to almost 2 hours deep in the podcast?
Yeah.
Very visceral.
I'm amazed
level.
We have any listeners at all. I mean, if we did, they're gone now.
Not yet, after this.
Yeah, so I guess we're coming up on 2 hours here. So are there any questions from IRC? Anything that we want to address in the last couple minutes of the cast?
We had a couple of good ones on the impromptu Sunday show. It's always welcome.
Yeah. Anybody
else? Looks like not.
Here's a question then. Did you guys see that crazy story about the guy wearing the Google glasses and somebody ripped him off of his face? And I didn't read the whole details. It didn't make any sense to me. Anybody know what was going on there?
Wait, what was this?
There was some guy that was wearing the Google goggles in public, and somebody else came up and ripped him off his face. And I guess it's a topic for a future show.
They just stole him? They just ripped him off his face and ran with him?
But it was like attached to his head somehow, and it caused him harm. And I don't know what the details were.
That's not cool.
News to me, but it sounds interesting.
Okay. Dick move.
I'll find it and post it for the next show.
Yeah, no.
Sounds
definitely.
Good. We already got the ball rolling for next week.
Yeah, well, I certainly think we had a great cast tonight.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It looks like it's about that time, approaching the 2 hour mark. This is Ronald McPaul watching the sunset on the Silicon Valley. We welcome you to check out the archives at declinefm.com to see our progress. And again, we are proud to announce the new official iTunes podcast, which is named, you guessed it, Decline to State. Remember, if there's a topic you want to hear on the show, please submit to r/declinetostate@reddit.com. And I would like to remind you that Decline to State is still brought to you free of charge as well as commercial free. A big thanks to all of our hosts, tech experts, researchers, contributors, and listeners, and also our 2 call-in listeners. Decline to State is a group effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as capitalist bow ties and free market monocles. So, and remember, when asked, always decline to state. This is Ron McPaul, signing off.
Yeah, and remember, guys, you can always talk on the IRC channel amongst yourselves and with us. We are now starting to take some questions from IRC. I think that's a great way to get more info on the show. And I want to also mention that you should definitely call in on Skype. We're getting better every day at working with the callers, and I really love every single caller that calls in, especially if you ask the tough questions. The tough questions are the best stuff. So call in, don't be afraid, and we'd love to have you on. That's Skype username, Decline to State. This is Eternal, and hope you guys have a great night.
This is Kwashi Orkar, and encouraging people to keep reading Hayek and get the word out.
This is Ninkendo signing off from Down Under.
All right, guys. Have a great night.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, I love the song.
Hell yeah. This is groovy.
I think I'm caught in some kind of purgatory.
For the first 10 million years, our people lived in furs and spears. Kill each other with their spears. There were no cars and no careers. No one thought of right and wrong. No, all they knew was weak and strong. Hunt and gather all day long and guard their butts from dusk till dawn. One day these 2 hairy guys, instead of fighting with their knives, came up with a compromise and called themselves civilized. They said, me is mine, you is yours, each free to keep his own rewards. We'll plant berries, beans, and gourds, and live in peace together.
Gourds. That's key.
Now let's get this straight. You won't tell me what to do. You don't own me, I don't own you. Death to those who think they do. They may be strong, but they be few. And you and I will long survive and multiply. I'll tell you why. Natural law cannot supply a means for thieves to unify. They'll cut each other's throats for us. others soon began to see a new thing called prosperity. All were welcomed happily, as long as each one would agree. Me is mine, you is yours, we'll settle our dispute in courts. We can build a mighty force and live in peace together. Now there were still disparities, more than some folks could bear to see. So they set up charities, all sharing voluntarily. Voluntarily, that's the key word. As they grew, they formed a state to fix the streets and guard the gates. But in time, received mandates to regulate and educate. And the unionized public teachers would say, me is mine, you is yours, our naive founding fathers' words. Those were simpler times. Let's all hand the state our swords and live in peace forever. The state would grow to dominate, to license, tax, and confiscate, to bribe their own electorate until it fell beneath its weight. Now they're just a swirling mob with stones and spears. They've got no jobs. They hunt and gather, kill and rob, and all was lost 'cause they forgot. Me is mine, you is yours, the law all law should reinforce. We can take no other course and live in peace together.